God, I know. We went with him in the ambulance. They operated, but he's in a coma. That's awful. Turns out this guy is the regular obituary writer, the guy I was covering for, Gordon Harris. Elaine gripped the blouse in her hand tighter. Gordon Harris? You know him? Elaine didn't speak for a moment, looked around the room as if searching for something, loosened her grip on the blouse a little. I met him a long time ago. He worked with Ian. So he knew Dad? Years ago. Anyway, his wife was all over the place. Wife? Yeah. Apparently he had a history of mental problems. Like, as if we don't know what that's like, eh? Martha was trying to make a joke about it. That's terrible, Elaine said. She went back to throwing dirty clothes into the machine. You got anything else to go in here? She was trying too hard to be casual. Martha shook her head and downed the rest of her coffee in one, went to pour another. Should you be going back into the office? Elaine said. Martha had been waiting for this. Elaine didn't want her there, had something against that place and the people. Martha had always put it down to antagonism towards Ian, but she wasn't sure that added up anymore. Ian was dead now, so what the hell? I'll be fine. Elaine looked at her directly. It made Martha realise her mother hadn't held her eye the whole time she'd been telling her about Gordon. You don't need this kind of thing, Martha, Elaine said. Please don't say, in my condition. It makes me sound pregnant. You're not, are you? Martha laughed. No. Because that's something else that could seriously affect... Elaine, please, I'm fine. Don't call me that. She stepped forward and raised her hand to Martha's cheek. Martha flinched and pulled away. And before you say anything, yes, I remember all the previous episodes, and I know I have my appointment tomorrow, and you don't need to come because Cal said he would. Okay, Mum? You called me Mum by accident. Isn't that sweet? Look, Elaine, that spoiled teenager voice again. I'm not some fragile little nut job that you have to tiptoe round anymore. You don't remember the worst of it. I hate that, Martha said, her voice raised. I hate how you become the official historian for my fucking depression, like you own the facts of it. I have it. I had the breakdowns. I had the incidents. I had the 15 different medications, the time in the loony bin. I remember, Elaine. I know you do, sweetheart. I'm just saying, well, don't. I'm not that person anymore. I'm a big girl and I can look after myself. I'm still your mum. Martha took a deep breath. Every conversation with Elaine seemed to end up the same way. You have to let me live my own life. Elaine backed off, poured liquid in the washing machine drawer and switched it on. The room filled with the whoosh and whir of the drum spinning, the scoosh of water and soap. Says the woman parading around in her underwear, shouting and stinking of booze. Please put some clothes on, Martha. Martha saluted. Yes, boss. She meant it to be sarcastic, but it came out subdued. She headed out the kitchen and upstairs, thinking about tomorrow's appointment and hoping that Cal would go with her, even though she hadn't asked yet. Chapter 20. Martha made straight for the grave this time. She wanted a quick word. No wind in the oaks today, sunlight playing through the leaves. A tortoiseshell cat with a long tail trotted along parallel to her for a while. She thought of yesterday's wood pigeon, the notion of reincarnation. She stopped at Ian's headstone and turned. She was being melodramatic. There was no one else in sight, but she felt like she was on stage, putting on a show. She was about to speak when she noticed fresh flowers on the grave, a small bunch of lilies. She reached down and picked them up. No card, no message. Who would leave flowers? Someone from the office? Did he have people who cared about him that she didn't know about? Martha looked round the graveyard again. Couldn't see the cat anymore. It had skulked away into a clump of trees by the fence. She felt like she was being watched. Stupid feeling. Straight out of a cheap horror movie, the kind Cal subjected her to. Martha pictured herself as the idiotic damsel in distress, going out into the graveyard alone, against the advice of the grizzled old-timer at the local store who warned her about the suspicious goings-on up at the old haunted cemetery. She shook her head to dismiss the idea, threw the flowers back down onto the turned earth at her feet. "So, that was some first day at work yesterday," she said to Ian. "Is it always like that?" She chewed on her lip and raised her eyebrows. "Still got nothing to say for yourself, huh?" She shook her head. "What's going on at the Standard anyway? It's a regular little suicide club down there. I know things are bad in the newspaper business, but come on. That's two you tried to top yourself in a fortnight. There must have been some fucking depressing paying conditions in your contract. Or maybe your generation have just discovered how shit life is. Took you long enough." Martha turned away from the gravestone and looked around. "Well, much as I enjoy our little chats, Ian, I've got somewhere I have to be." She noticed movement amongst the trees and got that feeling again of being watched. She imagined the soundtrack, atonal creepy notes building slowly, indicating a madman wielding a chainsaw just behind the nearest oak. She jumped when the cat crept out from behind a tree and headed in her direction. It was padding straight for her, carrying something in its mouth. She pictured it leaping out of the branches of a tree and grabbing the wood pigeon by the throat, ripping it to pieces, tearing the life out of it. But as the cat got closer, she realised it wasn't carrying the wood pigeon, but a rat. The sight of the tail made her queasy. Something about that rope-like extension, the baldness of it. The cat slowed. It had a submissive look on its face as it snuck the last few feet and laid the rat down in front of her, on top of Ian's grave. The rat twitched its front feet and jerked its head around, but it couldn't get up. Its throat was hanging open and the cat had made a mess of the flesh around its belly. Martha gagged. The rat began frantically thrashing its head about as the cat retreated. The cat looked first at her, then at the prize it had brought her. She had to do something. She stepped forward and placed the heel of her shoe on the rat's head, heard the skull crush beneath her foot and felt it up through her leg, swiveled her heel to be sure. She stepped back, dragging her foot on the grass, trying to wipe away rat brains. She looked at the cat. "You're a sick fuck," she said. The cat looked pleased with itself as it jogged away. Martha stared at the rat, its head a mush of fur and brains. It lay on the grave like a superstitious offering from a primitive tribe. She should move it, but she couldn't touch it with her hands, and she didn't want to get any more dead rat on her shoes. "Jesus Christ," she said, as she turned away from Ian and strode towards the exit. Chapter 21. As she got on the bus, she threw a random tape into the Walkman. A Spanish woman's voice, lots of reverb, then a riff. She looked at the box. Jane's Addiction. Ritual de lo Habitual. A guy with a squeaky voice shrieking over some funk metal. Strange. She pulled the printout of Ian's obituary from her bag, smudged her thumb against the picture of him, pint glass aloft. Tried to imagine the decomposing corpse in the graveyard, or his smashed-up body underneath North Bridge. She read the obit for the sixth time this morning. Born 13th of February 1970 in Edinburgh. Died 17th of March 2014 in Edinburgh, aged 44. Sometimes the word colleague just isn't enough. Ian Lamb, who died in the early hours of Monday morning after falling from North Bridge, was a distinguished colleague of everyone he worked with at the Standard newspaper, but he was so much more besides. From his early days as a trainee reporter on the Standard sister paper, the Evening Standard, through to his more recent days as an accomplished and astute news editor, Ian was a companionable and compassionate presence, always ready to listen to the usual workplace gripes, but also to provide vital encouragement to all around him. Back in 1991, Ian was studying journalism at Edinburgh University. I first met him around this time through a mutual love of the indie and grunge music scenes. Ian was a decent guitarist, I remember. He never treated that side of things as anything more than an interesting hobby, although by general consensus, he could have made a career out of music if he'd set his mind to it. In fact, that applied to most things about Ian. Ahead of anyone else in his journalism class, he landed a prestigious work placement as a trainee crime reporter with the Evening Standard, at a time when the newspaper industry was flying high and competition was fierce. Ian was already working as a freelance writer, penning gig and album reviews, and contributing heavily to the music fanzines and magazines, both local and national, but he craved something more serious. His nose for news stood him in good stead at the Evening Standard, where he rose quickly through the ranks of crime reporting and then news journalism. He was responsible for breaking any number of high-profile stories at the paper over the years, from the Hearts FC tax scandal to the terrible revelations about the disposal of remains at Morton Hall Crematorium. When a vacancy came up at the Standard for a news editor, Ian seemed the obvious choice. He brought to the role something of his dark sense of humour, as well as a down-to-earth quality that marked the paper's news gathering for subsequent years. Latterly, Ian was less than enamoured with the way things were going within the newspaper industry in general, and at the Standard in particular. He was heard to comment on more than one occasion that in a few years all this would be gone, and yet he maintained impeccable levels of professionalism from the moment he entered the office until the moment he left. Outside of the office, Ian was an intensely private man and mostly kept himself to himself. I suppose I knew him as well as anyone, and indeed it was he who first persuaded me to apply for a job at the Evening Standard where he was working. So really, I have my whole career to thank him for. Anyone who knew him knew that Ian was private for a reason. He had suffered on and off from depression over the years, and it occasionally hung over him like a cloud. In later years, however, he seemed to have found a combination of treatments that worked effectively at keeping his mood swings under control. However, the overwhelming memories of Ian are happy ones. Consulting with colleagues here in the office, we were continually to be found laughing at recollections of his anecdotes and wit. Ian Lamb was brought up in Edinburgh by his widowed mother, where he was a bright and popular pupil at Sheen's Primary School, then at Boroughmuir High School. He claimed it was his mother's proudest moment when he received an unconditional acceptance to study at Edinburgh University. The fact that he never finished his degree, instead becoming a full-time employee at the paper, always annoyed him, for her sake. But he was nothing if not a pragmatist in the workplace, as in life. His mother died at the end of 1992 from a stroke, shortly after he began working at the paper, and that death always cast a shadow over Ian's life and considerable achievements, in his own eyes at least. Nevertheless, in the 2 decades that followed, he carved an impressive life and career out for himself, creating a lasting impression not only on the people he leaves behind, but on the institution of the press in this country. Ian is survived by his daughter Martha and by his son Calvin. By Gordon Harris. It was well written, but cagey. All obits were cagey. They hedged around the less savoury elements of the subject's life, but this seemed especially vague. Concentrated almost entirely on his work at the expense of anything else. Virtually no mention of his upbringing or early life. Martha wondered about that. Tried to think what Elaine had mentioned about Ian's life over the years, and came up blank. She liked that bit at the end. Ian is survived by his daughter Martha and by his son Calvin. Simple, direct, to the point. She was a survivor. It was official. It felt strange to be a survivor. The guy on the tape was singing about being caught stealing. There were dogs barking all over the song. What the hell? Martha had been nabbed in the take once, 8 years old. A whisper out of McCall's. Everyone was doing it. It was a dare, a rite of passage. She was the only one got caught. Elaine gave her total shit for it. Martha didn't get off the bus at the Bridges. She was deliberately 2 hours early. Instead, she headed all the way south to Little France, to the ERI, to see Gordon. She pictured his face smeared across that room in Leith Links. She didn't know why she was going to see a man in a coma. She looked at Ian's obituary again, this time rubbed her finger over the byline. Gordon Harris. She switched off the Screechy Guys band and slipped in that tape, the tape of her conversation with Gordon. The bus stopped and started down Clark Street and Newington as she listened, her hands tight around the Walkman, squeezing it, feeling the give in the lid, the springs on the hinge tensing and relaxing. Bang! Her shouting again, silence, then Billy, more silence. Then that noise again. It didn't sound right, didn't feel right, something was wrong with all this. That's why she was going to see a man in a coma. To shake him awake, to ask him what really happened. Chapter 22. Different nurse at the intensive care desk. I'm his daughter, Martha said, putting on sad eyes. Electronic click. She pulled the handle and was through. Stood at the other side of the door, waiting for it to glide shut. Pressed her back against the wall for a moment, closed her eyes, and opened them again. The light was dimmer in here, less stressful. The whir and hum of machines was louder, the constant buzz of keeping people alive. Martha wondered what it would be like to work here, saving lives and watching people die. She had a tension across her forehead, pressed her thumbs into her eyebrows and rolled them downwards, heard the familiar crunch and pop, like a stiff back having the knots massaged out. She wondered about that sound. What was making it exactly? Muscle? Sinew? Cartilage? A nurse would know. Maybe she should ask one. She looked around. There was no one in the corridor. She made her way to Gordon's room, fourth on the left, stood in the doorway. Samantha was at the bedside, same as before. Martha wondered if she'd been home at all to face the mess her husband had made. Maybe better to stay here forever. Mrs. Harris? Samantha turned. All energy had drained from her face since yesterday, and she gave off an air of deep sadness and resignation. She shook her head at Martha, an aimless, almost involuntary movement. Martha walked towards her. I'm Martha. We met yesterday. Samantha shook her head again, more forcefully this time. I'm sorry, I don't remember. I work at the Standard. I was covering the obit desk when your husband phoned in. Samantha's face crumpled a little more. Increments of grief. Martha put a hand on her shoulder, but it felt wasted and awkward. There was nothing here between them. Martha was worse than useless. She was here to pester and intrude, and she knew it. She took her hand away. I remember now, Samantha said. Martha looked at Gordon in bed. There was very little change from yesterday, except he seemed somehow smaller, like he'd shrunk away from the world. His face was still covered in gauze, the oxygen mask on, the machines pumping and wheezing. Martha stared at his hand on top of the white sheet where a drip was feeding in. The tape holding the tube had come away from his skin at one corner, and she reached forward and smoothed it down, then felt weird about touching his hand in front of his wife. Martha didn't know him, but she felt connected. The phone call, the sound of it, the feel of it. She was linked to all this now, linked to him for as long as he remained alive. Maybe longer. She pulled up a seat next to Samantha and laid her hands in her lap. How is he? Samantha shook her head. No change overnight. The machines are keeping him alive. Brain function is low. His body's still in shock. But he'll come out of the coma, won't he? Samantha sighed. They say it's still too early to tell.
I don't think they're very hopeful, but they're not telling me that. I'm so sorry.
Martha noticed a small bunch of lilies in a vase on the table next to the bed. She got up and examined them, similar to the flowers on Ian's grave. Small white flowers, the petals unopened. Weren't lilies supposed to be for dead people? She fingered the stems, looking for a card. Nothing. Lovely flowers, she said. Samantha stared at her, then the vase. She looked as if she hadn't noticed the flowers before.
Who sent them? Martha said. A relative?
I don't know. Martha smelled the flowers. Not much of a scent with the blooms still closed. She sat down again.
How was he? Samantha said.
What? Samantha didn't take her eyes off Gordon in the bed.
When you spoke to him yesterday, how was he?
Martha thought about it.
Very upset, distressed.
Samantha's head dropped a little and she closed her eyes. Martha looked at the creases around the woman's eyes.
So tired. How did he seem when you last saw him?
Samantha shook her head.
Fine. That's the bizarre thing. I mean, he's suffered from depression in the past, on and off, but not for years.
Maybe he was hiding it from you. Martha found herself taking the other woman's hand in hers.
That's very common for people suffering from depression, to hide it really well from loved ones. How would you know?
I've suffered from it all my life. Diagnosed 8 years ago, but I knew there was something wrong way before that. Samantha looked up.
Really? But you're so young.
It has nothing to do with age, Martha said. It's a mental disorder, that's all. Samantha sighed.
I read all about it. The leaflets when Gordon was diagnosed. Then weeks online looking for answers. Buying loads of books, getting medicated, looking for alternatives.
That all sounds very familiar.
But that was years ago. There's been nothing recently, no sign it was coming back.
Like I said, maybe he was hiding it. Samantha pulled her hand away abruptly.
And what am I supposed to do with that information?
Her tone had hardened.
What the hell am I supposed to do in the face of that little nugget of wisdom?
Martha put her hand up, placating.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean any offence. You have no idea what it's like, Samantha said. The deceit of it all, the disregard for others, the selfishness.
Actually, my dad killed himself a fortnight ago. Samantha stared at Martha for a long time. Her breathing slackened and the fight seemed to go out of her.
Then, you do know.
I've felt suicidal in the past, Martha said, and even I don't understand it. There's no point attributing rational thought patterns to people in that mindset. I think of myself when I was like that, and it seems like a different person, a ghost almost.
A ghost? Samantha said, like an echo. A ghost who somehow managed to get hold of a gun and keep it secret from his wife in their own home.
Martha angled her head.
You've no idea where he got it. I never heard him talk about a gun. Ever. I certainly wouldn't have had one in the house. I told the police that.
There are apparently pubs in Leith where you can buy firearms.
You're saying it was planned. There was premeditation.
Martha shrugged.
I'm sorry, I'm just trying to work out what happened.
Samantha rubbed at her eye.
Why?
Martha felt the tension return across her forehead, longed to push her knuckles into her eye sockets.
Don't you want to know what happened?
Samantha's eyes were wet now.
I know what happened. My husband tried to kill himself.
Martha thought about the cassette in her bag, the noise at the end of the phone call. She thought about bringing it up. Didn't. She got up and stood over Gordon's body. His chest was rising and falling softly, in time with the wheeze of the life support machine. She caught a faint whiff of the lilies from the bedside table, just a tiny trace. Samantha was sniffling into a tissue. Martha touched Samantha's shoulder as she walked away. It felt like the most useless gesture imaginable. Chapter 23. Martha stopped outside the hospital and sucked in air. Something about the sterilised atmosphere inside felt like it had petrified her lungs. She gulped in freshness, springtime. Her work skirt felt tight, the elastic digging into her flesh. She fiddled with it, running her fingers around the inside of the waistband. She kneaded away at her forehead, scrunching her eyes closed, then blinking them open a few times. She looked around. She was getting stared at by two old men in pyjamas, slippers and dressing gowns at the other side of the entrance. They were both smoking, cigarettes cupped into their palms against the breeze. One of them had a drip on wheels and was using the pole to keep himself upright. He had yellow fingers and a sickly tinge to the grey beard around his mouth. The other one was in a wheelchair and looked like death warmed up. Martha stared back and they both turned away. She imagined what their bodies looked like under their clothes. Cancerous cells eating away the healthy ones. Hefty scars on chests or stomachs. Pouches of skin. Wrinkles. Decay. We're all dying in our own tedious ways. She was about to head for the bus stop when she saw Rose walking towards the entrance carrying a small bouquet of carnations. She had a self-absorbed look in her face which lifted when she spotted Martha. Rose? Martha said. Martha? Martha nodded at the flowers. Visiting someone? Gordon, obviously. I thought you didn't know him that well. We knew each other back in the day. Martha raised her eyebrows. Oh, yeah? Rose shook her head. Nothing like that. So how come you're visiting him? Rose shrugged. I thought someone from the office should, and I didn't think there would be many offers to traipse out here. They're a hard-hearted lot down there. Whereas you're full of the milk of human kindness. Something like that, Rose said. Why are you here to see him? What makes you think I'm here to see him? Rose gave her a sceptical look. Martha said, Why do you think he tried to kill himself? Why does anyone? Rose said. Gordon has had a lot of problems with depression and maybe he felt guilty. About what? Martha said. We all carry guilt around with us, don't we? Speak for yourself, Martha said. Rose laughed. I used to be just like you. Martha scrunched up her nose. What changed? I grew up. Is that why you're shacked up with a boy half your age? Billy is just crashing in my spare room while he gets back on his feet. Do you think it's wise having a criminal stay in your spare room? Billy's never been convicted of any crime, Rose said. And I know you like him, and he likes you. Martha looked down, spotted a smudge in her heel, the remains of rat brains from the graveyard. She cleared her throat. This isn't the playground. I couldn't care less if he likes me. Whatever you say, Martha sighed. Oh, my God, you're so annoying, Rose smiled. You are just like I was at your age. If you say that one more time, I'll take those flowers and beat you round the head with them. That's the kind of thing I would have said. Martha shook her head and looked at her watch. I can't stand around here blethering all day. I need to get to the office. The dead wait for no one, eh? Whatever. Martha made to walk away, but Rose touched her arm. Just be gentle with Billy, okay? He's been through a lot. There's nothing between Billy and me. Women like us, Martha, it's easy to hurt the people we care about. That's all. She let go of Martha's sleeve and headed into the hospital, the automatic doors swishing and shushing. Martha saw the two smokers staring at her again, faces scowling and closed. She turned and headed to work. Chapter 24. Martha sat at Gordon's desk and stared at the screen. The obit in front of her had her welling up. She didn't know the guy, but he'd lived a long and satisfying life, and she could tell by reading it that there was so much love in his life, from family, friends, those he worked with. The picture was the usual old white man, thinning grey hair, open-necked shirt. Could have been anyone's granddad. Could have been Martha's granddad, if she had any left alive. Why did everyone in her family die so young? There was never a fluke family obituary like this. 800 words of understated praise, heartwarming details like his job surveying the remote Canadian wilderness, or his time building schools in Kenya, or his national service in Saudi Arabia, or his rumoured involvement in the disappearance of the Stone of Scone. This was a life. This was grabbing life for all it was worth. What did Martha have to compare? Several years of medication and treatment for mental illness. A placement as a trainee journalist, still living at home with her brother and her mum. Then what? She tried to imagine herself in old age, dying at 89, like this guy on the page in front of her, Derek Simpson. Some random guy she'd never met, but whose life had reduced her to sniffing into a tissue and wiping her eyes. She tried to picture herself as an old maid, hair wispy and thin, knuckles swollen by arthritis, papery skin, bifocals on a piece of string round her neck. They could run a picture of her surrounded by frayed rugs and cats. She tried to imagine dying after a brave battle with bowel cancer, surrounded in her last moments by doting friends and family. Nope. Couldn't see it. Just couldn't see it. She worked out that if she lived to be 89, she would die in 2082. Jesus Christ, that was never going to happen. There won't even be newspapers then. We will either have transcended to a higher plane of existence or be living on Mars. Or more likely, we'll have reverted to warring cannibalistic savages shivering in caves against a harsh new ice age of our own making. Martha took a deep breath and held it. Not the relaxation techniques she'd been taught, but it sometimes worked. She wiped away the smudges from her eyes. She was supposed to be working. She had to get her shit together. She checked through the obit again, trying to disengage from the subject matter and look at it objectively. Searching for typos, clumsy language, anything that might be dubious or get the paper into trouble. She triple-checked the dates of birth and death, the picture caption and intro, tidied up the edges of the columns, got rid of a couple of hyphens, made sure the text flowed through the page as smoothly as possible. Done. One dead man down, the rest of the page to go. She looked at the clock on the screen. 2:13 p.m. 6 more minutes, and it would be exactly 24 hours since that call. She was surprised she remembered. She'd looked at the same clock on the same screen yesterday when the phone rang. Hadn't registered at the time. What else could she remember if she put her mind to it? So it hadn't even been a full day since Gordon had done it. Felt like years. The phone rang. She jumped. Stared at it. "You're shitting me," she said. Let it ring. Seriously, if this is... Deep breath. Picked up the phone. "Hello? The standard obituary desk, this is Martha Fluke." The sound of someone crying and sniffling. Martha rubbed her fingers on the bridge of her nose. "Hello?
I'm sorry.
Take your time.
It's about my husband."
Martha had her pen and pad at the ready. "Go on." In amongst the sound of snuffles and gasps, she heard,
"Wallace."
She put on her softest voice.
"Is Wallace his first or last name?" "Surname." For the next 10 minutes, she provided a shoulder to cry on. Mrs. Wallace's husband had finally succumbed to some form of dementia. He'd spent the last 2 years unaware of where or who he was, unable to recognise his wife and children, angry and aggressive to all visitors until the last 2 weeks, when he became serene and childlike. Martha couldn't use a single word of this stuff. The manner of death was usually skirted over, especially something harrowing like this. No one wanted to read about Mr. Wallace's years lost in the wilderness of his own frazzled brain. They wanted to remember the man who'd been instrumental in setting up a cookery school for underprivileged kids in Perth long before the modern-day obsession with cuisine as porn. They wanted to hear about his antics on his gap year, where he travelled to Australia and was almost bitten by a shark off the Great Barrier Reef. Martha kept Mrs. Wallace talking, thinking of what V had said about getting the bereaved to write the thing themselves. She made a few tentative steps towards suggesting it, but her heart wasn't in it. Wallace had died this morning, for Christ's sake. His widow wasn't in any mood to hit a deadline. Martha took down a few more details, then told Mrs. Wallace that one of the paper's regular freelancers would be in touch to interview her properly. Truth was, Wallace wouldn't make more than a sidebar, if that. Depended who else shuffled off their mortal coil in the next few days. Eventually, Mrs. Wallace hung up the phone, still sniffling.
"Didn't get the appreciation, huh?"
It was V next to her. Martha shook her head.
"You need to try harder than that," V said. "You'll understand after a month, when they review the budgets and haul you into the office, roast your ass."
Martha shrugged. The phone rang again.
"Busy time for dead people," V said, not taking her eyes off her screen.
Martha picked up.
"Hello?
Martha Fluke on the obituary desk. Can I help?" Silence. Breathing. Martha felt a shiver.
"Hello?"
She heard a man clear his throat.
"Hello, sir. Can I help you?"
V was rolling her eyes at the next desk. Martha tried one last time.
"Hello? Is there someone there?"
The clearing of a throat again. Then a voice.
"Did you say Fluke?"
"Yes, Martha. I'm the obituaries editor here at the Standard." A beat. Another. This was like pulling teeth.
"You sound so young," the man said.
There was something about his voice. Edinburgh accent. Something familiar, but somehow different.
"I've not been in the job long."
"I'll bet."
What did that mean?
"But I'm perfectly capable."
Martha Fluke.
Martha rolled her eyes at V, who laughed and shook her head.
"Can I ask what you're calling about?"
Click. Dial tone. Martha held the handset up to V.
Prick hung up. "Happens a lot. The bereaved are an emotional bunch." "He doesn't sound very emotional."
"They don't sometimes, especially the blokes. Keep it barrelled up. That's the macho Scottish way, right?"
"He kept asking about my surname."
V turned away from her letters page.
"Yeah, I meant to mention that. You probably don't want to be giving your name out."
"Why not?"
"Get a lot of nut jobs attracted to death. Makes sense to keep that information to yourself until you know the person on the phone is legit. That goes double for men. Perverts."
Martha did 1471. Number withheld. She felt a tremor through her body, but shrugged it off.
"People withhold numbers all the time. Networks don't provide them. Blah, blah."
But still,
it was something in the guy's voice. Familiar, yet different. She couldn't put her finger on it.
V gave off an exasperated grunt.
"Fucking wind farms," she said.
She held up a letter she'd just opened, covered in a red scrawl.
"Can't these assholes come up with anything else to moan about other than wind farms? I'd like to stick all their faces in the blades of a turbine."
She ripped the letter into confetti and threw it in the bin.
Martha checked her email. Two new messages about dead people. She began to read, but kept thinking about that man's voice, trying to work out what was so familiar about it. Chapter 25. Billy came by her desk at 6 and put on his squint smile. Fancy grabbing a sandwich? Martha realised she hadn't eaten all day. That was one way of losing weight. Maybe by the end of her stint here she'd be svelte and willowy. She looked at her screen, then at V. V waved at her.
You know the ropes already, girlfriend. Pages are nearly set. We're ahead of schedule. Go break some bread with lover boy.
Billy stuck his middle finger up at V, his smile getting more lopsided.
Don't tempt me, V said. I will sit on that and break it off.
Billy made a show of shuddering, and Martha smiled. Come on, she said, getting up. As they headed downstairs to the canteen, Martha stole glances at the scar on the back of Billy's head. She had read about it. An emergency decompressive craniotomy, one of the newspaper reports had said, otherwise known as a hole in the head to let the pressure out. She felt the pressure inside her own skull, took a deep breath and thought about her ECT appointment first thing tomorrow. She still hadn't checked that Cal was going to come with her. Wasn't ideal that she had to come to work after, but it was doable. She had a few hours to recover at home. She wondered about trying to explain it all to Billy, but he would be just like everyone else, imagining Jack Nicholson in Cuckoo's Nest, thrashing around and biting down on a gum shield like a madman. She had footage of herself from her first visit. They weren't supposed to, but Cal filmed it on his phone. She asked him to, so she would know exactly what they were doing. She'd been reassured by all the doctors, but needed to see for herself. She looked serene in the footage. Under anaesthetic, controlled voltage applied, end of story. No jerking spasms, no furrowed brow, no manic staring and wild-eyed panic. Just resetting the mind. That old IT joke about switching it off and on again. Worked 9 times out of 10. Reboot your personality. And a feeling afterwards, as if that heavy, wet blanket had been lifted from her mind. Like her body was a landmass after the glacier had melted and the water run off. All her senses were buoyed. She could smell things again. Only then did she realise her senses had been dulled by illness, by medication. She could smell the earthy stink of her armpits when she hadn't washed. She could smell when she was on her period. She felt alive again, back in the world. What are you smiling at? Billy said. Nothing. They got sandwiches and coffee and grabbed a table next to the window, the crags looming over them. I met Rose today at the hospital, Martha said. Billy chewed thoughtfully. There to see Gordon? Martha nodded. She had flowers. I thought she didn't know him that well. That's what I thought too. And you are best friends? Don't say it like that. Like what? Like we're fucking, we're not. Fine. Billy lowered his sandwich. What were you doing there? Martha shrugged. Just wanted to check on him. I feel connected, you know. I was the last person to speak to him. How's he doing? Not good. His wife was there. Billy was chewing again. You speak to her? Yeah. Anything? Martha shook her head. Not really. She doesn't think he's going to live. Shit. Yeah. She have any idea that he was going to do something like this? Don't think so. What about the gun? Does she know anything about that? Martha shook her head again. Did you hear anything from the police? Billy pulled a sheet of paper from his shirt pocket. Yeah, but nothing exciting. He unfolded the sheet. It was an Olympic BBM 9mm revolver. It's a starting pistol, converted to fire live ammunition. It's easy, a 2-hour job. About half the firearms the cops see are converted starting pistols. Means it was definitely bought in a pub or down a back street. No license or anything. Only his prints on it, obviously. Martha took a swig of coffee. I think that's what Samantha finds hardest.
What?
The premeditation of it. He went out and bought a gun. That's a lot of hassle. That's not just a spur-of-the-moment thing like pills or hanging. He had that gun in the house for a reason, and he kept it a secret for a reason. That's pretty fucked up. Imagine if someone you love did that behind your back.
Brutal.
Yeah.
They'd both finished eating by now. Billy took a last gulp of his coffee.
So, it doesn't look as if we have a new story, he said.
Doesn't look like it.
Shame. Martha raised her eyebrows.
Sure, but it's kind of more of a shame that one of your collies tried to kill himself, isn't it?
Of course, Billy said. I didn't mean it like that.
Silence between them. The canteen was virtually empty. The whole building was virtually empty. This business couldn't last. Martha wondered how she would earn a living in the future. What would all the journalists do?
Speaking of death, Billy said, how's the obit desk going?
Depressing, Martha said. I had a weeping widow earlier, and a weird guy who seemed obsessed with my surname, then hung up.
Billy shook his head.
Never tell them your name unless you have to.
So I'm learning.
Billy checked his watch.
I'd better get back. Got some death announcements I could be prepping for tomorrow. Get ahead of the game.
Yeah, me too.
What are you doing after shift? Billy said. Martha had been waiting for that question.
V has twisted my arm to go see a wrestle.
Really?
Want to come?
Billy smiled. Chapter 26. Summer Hall was packed. Martha drank her pint and looked round. They were in a large concrete box, a former abattoir apparently, still with some of the fixtures and fittings mounted on the walls, big rusty rings cemented in place, chains and hooks hanging down. There were 300 people in the room, arranged on cheap plastic chairs facing a wrestling ring in the middle. It was dark, with strobes flashing and some cheesy death metal bouncing around, guitar riffs echoing and arguing with each other. The crowd was made up of metal fans and comic book geeks, plus some obvious friends and family of the wrestlers, kids with large foam hands. We're number one. The bar was doing a roaring trade. Martha smiled as she soaked it up. She had no idea this world existed, in Edinburgh of all places. The atmosphere was completely non-threatening, like a pantomime for grown-ups. Billy and Cal were next to her talking to each other. She'd asked Cal about tomorrow. He was cool to chum her to the Royal Edinburgh, even though it was an 8:30 appointment. Who the hell wants to get their mind reset at 8:30 in the morning? Tonight was a good distraction. So what if she had a hangover tomorrow? In a stupid kind of way, she figured the ECT would wipe her hangover away too. So really, she had a free pass to drink as much as she liked. That way, madnessly. She looked at the running order for the night. It was a mixed bill, male and female, six bouts between them. V was second up. Her wrestling name was Vengeance. The picture of her was awesome. In a black spandex bra and hot pants, with her thick black fringe and grimacing for the camera, she looked like Joan Jett raging on steroids. Her opponent was someone called Buttercup, who looked 3 stone heavier than V and had a Mohican, arms covered in tattoos and a thick waist exposed in a spangly gold outfit. Skull-crushing thighs. Cal nudged her, eyes wide. This place is crazy. The death metal faded and a booming voiceover began rabble-rousing, getting the crowd hyped up. It was low-rent stuff, but it worked. Martha found herself going along with it, ironically at first, but she got sucked into the call and response like everyone else. Billy and Cal were the same, whooping it up. The first fighters came out to thudding hip-hop. Wolf against Viper. Martha shook her head.
Really?
Both guys had tidy beards and shoulder-length hair and were wearing tight shorts, sweatbands on their wrists, and comical grimaces. But once they got down to it, there was some serious intent. Okay, it was pantomime, but Martha found herself admiring the athleticism of these cartoonish guys. She couldn't climb a turnbuckle and leap off. She couldn't do a forward flip through the ropes onto the concrete floor. Who was she to mock them?
"This is awesome," Cal said over the crowd noise. "You think Viper might let me check out his trouser snake afterwards?"
Martha pursed her lips.
"Come on. Have you seen the muscles on these guys? And these outfits, man, they must be gay."
In the third round, Viper got Wolf pinned for a count. He sprang up, beating his chest in victory. Wolf took it badly and broke a chair over Viper's head on the way out. Everyone roared. Fee was up next on the card. Billy went to get beers before she appeared. Cal threw Martha a concerned look.
"You okay about tomorrow?"
"I'm fine."
"Should you be drinking?"
"I said I'm fine."
Cal looked at her.
"You're taking the day off, right? You're not going into work afterwards."
Martha didn't answer.
"That's nuts."
"It won't be a problem. Last time I felt fine after a couple of hours."
"If you just tell them, I'm sure they'll understand."
Martha sat upright.
"I'm not telling anyone at the office about this. You know what people think when you say ECT.
Cal looked away.
"Well, there might be a problem about that."
Martha's eyes widened. She grabbed Cal's jaw and turned his face to hers.
"You didn't."
"It was an accident. I thought Billy already knew."
Martha slapped his chin away.
"Fuck's sake, Cal."
"Sorry."
Billy returned with the beers. He was smiling. But Martha knew he knew. So what, he felt sorry for her? Thought she was crazy? Fuck that. She took her beer and faced the ring. The voiceover guy began again, whipping up the crowd for the second bout. V came out to "American Idiot" by Green Day. Nice touch. She was grimacing and laughing as she walked to the ring. Then she did a few backflips once she got on the canvas and ended with a gymnast pose.
Wow.
Buttercup came out to "Enter Sandman," punching the air and snarling. She was so much bigger than V. Once the bout got going, it was just as dumbly impressive as the last one. Lots of theatrics, playing up to the crowd, gooning at the front rows. Martha found herself screaming for V to get out of a chokehold. V slipped the hold, but she was tiring, hands on knees, chest heaving. Several rounds with this dump truck had taken it out of her. A few more slams into the canvas and up against the turnbuckles, and she was bumped down into a shoulder pin and counted out. V and Buttercup were immediately up, embracing and waving to the crowd, both soaking it in. No animosity after the bell this time. All friendly girls together.
"V!" Martha shouted over the crowd. "Hey!"
V caught her eye and waved. She had a broad grin on her face, despite getting beat. Her eyes glowed with something real amongst all the fakery, and Martha found that simple pleasure infectious. For a moment, she didn't think about ECT, her dad's suicide, Gordon in a coma, Billy's damaged brain, her own synapses and neurons misfiring, and just soaked in the applause, imagining it was for her. Chapter 27. The walls of the Royal Dick were covered in bleached animal bones and medical instruments, the pub having been converted from the old veterinary school along with Summer Hall next door. Martha sat with Billy and Cal, swigging her Erdinger and imagining animal ghosts haunting the room. Fee appeared wearing a ZZ Top cut-off, short leather skirt and knee-high boots. Cheers all round. Martha surprised herself by jumping up and hugging her. She felt V's firm muscles in her squeezed embrace.
"That was amazing," she said.
"Thanks, Flukester."
Martha introduced V to Cal and went to get the beers in. Billy came to help with the drinks.
"I can manage 4 pints myself," Martha said.
"I'm sure you can," Billy said.
When they returned to the table, Billy got a buzz in his pocket.
"What a stud your brother is," V said, nodding at Cal.
"He's gay," Martha said.
Well, duh, V said. She rubbed Cal's arm, making him laugh.
Any guy this buffed is bound to be. Nice eye candy, though.
Billy was looking at his phone. Oh, shit. Gordon's dead. Martha touched the table to steady herself as the world went a little off kilter.
Fuck, V said.
The obit guy, Cal said. V nodded. Martha looked at Billy's phone. Who's that?
Rose.
What does it say? He had some kind of massive brain seizure. No point keeping the machines on. His wife said they could pull the plug.
Shit,
Martha said. She slumped into her seat.
You okay? Billy said.
She nodded, an automatic response. She was okay. She wasn't the one who had shot his face off. She wasn't the one who had to go back to that house and look at the mess up the walls, soaked into the carpet, sprayed across the sofa. She wasn't the one who had jumped off North Bridge in the middle of the night when no one was around to talk him out of it, making sure to jump at the most effective place to kill himself. She didn't want to kill herself, despite it all, despite the darkness and the pressure between her eyes. She rubbed at her forehead, a pincer movement that made her wince. She felt Billy's hand on her back.
Don't,
she wriggled away from his touch. I'm fine. She picked up her pint and raised it.
To Gordon Harris.
They copied her. She took a big drink, loving the coldness of it in her throat, the fizz in her belly, and she wanted to feel alive. Chapter 28.
What the hell is Bad Motor Finger?
Martha was standing in Ian's living room with the album in one hand, glass of whiskey in the other.
Sounds rude, Cal said, like a dildo gone wrong.
The four of them were emptying out the dregs of Ian's booze shelf. Martha hated whiskey, but that's all there was left. That or Turkish brandy. V had made appreciative noises at the whiskey bottle, but it just tasted like antiseptic to Martha. It was doing a job, though. She struggled to focus on the back of the album cover. The other three were flumped on the sofa, passing the Ardbeg around. Martha pulled out the inside sleeve of the album.
Holy shit, look at this guy!
She handed it to V, who nodded.
Chris Cornell from Soundgarden, V said. He's been in the wank bank for years.
She scanned the sleeve notes.
Don't you know anything about grunge?
She passed the sleeve to Cal, who gave a whistle.
Oh, yeah, he said.
Billy shook his head. Martha smiled.
I'm sorry, are we upsetting you with our man lust?
Billy held his hands up in submission.
Hey, I'm not saying anything. I'm outnumbered 3-1.
Cal gave the record back to Martha, who slipped the vinyl out the sleeve and put it on. She was beginning to like the tactile experience of Ian's old records. A physical thing to hold on to. A chunk of black plastic or whatever it was that made a comforting scratchy sound when you slapped a needle on it. How archaic was that? Sticking a sharp point into a groove to make a sound. How the hell did they ever come up with that? She realised that since Ian's funeral, she hadn't listened to a single MP3 on her phone. Just his cassettes and records. She was regressing to the dark ages. A blistering riff leapt out the speakers, frantic drums and bass, then this stud Cornell screaming. He sounded good. In control.
Wow!
V got up to mooch around the living room.
So do you break into your dead dad's flat a lot?
Martha had explained to V about Ian back in the Royal Dick.
Quite a lot recently, Martha laughed.
V shook her head.
Haven't the neighbours noticed?
Martha shrugged. We closed the door behind us. They probably don't want to get involved. Maybe they think we're squatters and this is a crack den.
This is no crack den, V said. I should know.
Martha gave her an inquisitive look.
What can I say? V said. I've led a colourful life.
A sludgy, sleazy riff was chugging out the speakers now. Martha caught a line. I'm looking California and feeling Minnesota.
Nice.
Martha touched V's arm. There's something I want to tell you.
Shoot, sister.
Martha turned to Billy. You might as well hear this as well. She glanced at Cal. Although I know you already know because of Blabbermouth here.